The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by Le Tote, Intercepted, Blue Apron, and Simply Safe. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, the opinions and analysis of our guests belong to our guests. I should also warn you that the language in this week's addendum is a bit strong. Just want to give you a heads up. Enjoy the program.
I'm D. Watkins here with Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today I'll be joined by my co-host, Justine Barron. Justine Barron is a political and nonprofit consultant by day and a film and TV writer by night. Her clients have included the Cesar Chavez Foundation, Columbia University, Anti-Defamation League, and many others. She also writes a column on crime and media for the Jewish Journal. I also have Kelly Hosley, the fiance of Keith Davis Jr., who was shot by Baltimore City Police Department and then falsely charged twice, having been acquitted on all 15 original false charges. Kelly has been an advocate fighting for him to be freed. We also have Tracy Wilson Kleeklamp joining us today. She has been a neighborhood and community activist for over 20 years, advocating for community-oriented policing, public parks, transparent, responsive local government, and sustainable urban planning. She is also the president of Race Matters Friends, a nonprofit organization focused on social justice issues and advocacy in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, how you guys doing? Thank you for joining us. Let's just start with you, Justine, with some of the things that we're covering in the episode and some things that everyone needs to know so that we can frame this conversation the right way.
For me, at least, I found this topic to be endlessly complicated. The puzzle of how police investigate themselves, I still feel like there's pieces of it I don't fully understand after investigating it for 6 months. And every time I talk to another lawyer or police officer or scholar, I would get another sort of look at it. But I think the important thing to talk about here is we think about internal affairs, investigating cops. That's what we see on television, right? And it's different. It's more complicated than that. Internal affairs is very, very limited. That's what they call the administrative investigation. They're just looking at policies, violations of policy, and every department has its own policies, and those policies are updated every year. So you might think, okay, you put your knee in the back of Freddie Gray while he's laying there, while you have his legs up and he's basically hogtied. That's excessive force. But there may not be any policy saying that that's a problem, and that might have been covered in the training academy, and the training academy may never have talked about how long you should do that for. So there may not be any violation of internal affairs, but that administrative investigation will say, okay, well, we need to revise our policies. So that's the point of that one.
But there was no real clear evidence of what type of training these people were receiving, right?
Well, they keep it secret. You know, we have MPIA requests. I requested all kinds of information about different types of training. I did get the policies, and that was very helpful. And presumably the training is based on the policies, but not in every case. I mean, the cops told me that they've added differences between legal and illegal knives to their training, but I don't see any policies about it. So it's very hard to know how they get trained. I had to find out how cops get trained by talking to them. And for the most part, they go to the academy and they don't remember any of it because they get out on the streets and they're told to forget it and that it has nothing to do with real police work. So then you have this administrative investigation that is based on these policies that the cops aren't even really sort of indirectly trained to enforce. I don't know if that makes sense. That's internal affairs.
Well, they look so good on television. Internal affairs, they're so scary on TV. It's like they pop up, you know, they normally wear like a vest with like dark frame glasses, and they make all the other police officers uneasy as they walk around the department, and people are whispering to each other saying, yo, internal affairs are here. We gotta act right. But in real life, it's not like that.
Well, okay. So on TV, you have good guy cops, and then you have like sort of the bad guy internal affairs, and then there'll be like one episode a season where there's a bad cop and suddenly internal affairs is good, right? Something like that.
Right.
Reality, I don't know reality because in this, I think it's per department, but first of all, smaller police departments don't even have internal affairs. But Baltimore, what happened is they did a criminal investigation first, and Criminal investigations is not internal affairs. It's not supposed to be. It's not looking at policy. It's really treating the police officer like a civilian and seeing if they broke the law.
But and that's not what happened in this case.
It was supposed to be what happened. And eventually, when the task force took over, that was the homicide department leading a criminal investigation. But I think we've shown, and we've definitely believed, that it was, once they saw that charges were coming down or felt that pressure from the state's attorney, they became very defensive, and they weren't really open to exploring the reality of law breaking. So that's why this case is particularly a huge mess. It's a mess for a few reasons. The FIT team, the force investigation team, was never created with the clarity about what kind of investigation it was supposed to do. And that, starting right there, I mean, I hope we spelled out there's a huge difference between those two investigations. If you're looking at whether somebody broke the law, you have to be taking very seriously everything they say, whether anybody is lying. I mean, that's supposed to be what's happening. You have to be looking at all the evidence, pulling it all in. You have to keep witnesses apart from each other, you know, and possible offenders.
How can you investigate police officers like criminals when their culture doesn't really exist? So maybe the first thing that come to their mind was, oh, well, we're going to handle this as a matter of them losing their jobs or not, because there's no way in the world could they actually go to jail. This system doesn't, we don't arrest cops. Cops can kill infants. They can take their boots and grind them into the skulls of the elderly, and they don't arrest cops.
So mostly you're right. Mostly it doesn't happen. Sometimes it happens. And, you know, with that McWhite case, like, they will go after cops, Batts and his people. And previous to Batts, cops will get arrested for crimes. They tried to indict the officer who in 2014, I believe, beat someone up at a bus station, and that was caught on video. Batts and his team wanted to indict him criminally. So sometimes they will use that power. But it feels very, like, political.
It has to be like a PR thing.
PR, yeah. Or I mean, McWhite wasn't PR. He was just an older cop who may or may not have taken $1,700 extra dollars by saying he had an educational degree that he paid for. But they have these, like, diploma mails. So in that case, it wasn't PR. I think it was just politics, like somebody they wanted out, you know? So it does happen. The problem is the systems are not in place. It's kind of new to look at cops that way, and it's very messy. And then you have these force investigation task force. Both of those were PR stunts. Neither of them were operating with clarity or integrity, you know? So I hope that spells that out. So just to quickly wrap it up, what happened in this case is that they theoretically put off the administrative investigation, and it didn't happen until after the trials. And they outsourced it because, it all looked so bad. They outsourced it to Montgomery County and Howard County. And then we just got word that they have some initial findings, but we could talk about that later. And the structure of how to do these things, administrative and criminal, I mean, honestly, I could go on and on about how complicated it is and how even the experts are still trying to figure out how to do this right, you know?
Yeah, well, I want to give Kelly a chance to tell her story. But first, I would just like Tracy to respond to what you said. Just give us some more clarity from just like a community perspective.
So one of the things that I noticed in looking at this is it's by design. It's by design to be confusing, and it's designed to protect a police culture that believes that it is does not need to be held accountable. They are their own police. They are the law. And also, I'm really curious, I've been doing a lot of research on police curriculum and training, and they only use about 10% of what they get from the academy. And so there's this huge sort of difference between the traditional model where you're trained and you do these tasks versus community-oriented policing, where you're supposed to be thinking and breathing and be more of a human being with the community. And by and large, the police really object to that. So not just in Baltimore, but police departments around the country really struggling with who we serve. So to me, the way that the whole investigation thing works or doesn't work is because there's no standard. So everybody gets to design a system that they want, and there's no accountability for it. And what all I wrote on my notes is, oh my God, over and over and over again. But it's typical. I mean, it's typical. My experience, just even recently, a shooting here in Columbia, the police chief refuses to come out and speak publicly about it. They shot a man who was in a moment of mental distress. He's shooting a gun in the air. And they said that he got in a gunfight with the police. And so they shot him. Now, I really don't care if they come back and say it's justified or not. Just because the police say it's justified doesn't mean it's right. And I'll go to hell thinking that. I don't care. But at the end of the day, I think the police have a responsibility to be visible and transparent about what they're doing. And those are very loaded words, because in their minds, they're still thinking, we're going to tell you what we want you to know, and we're only going to show up to talk to you when we feel like it. That's the translation I get all over the map on what I see here between this criminal and administrative. There's no commitment at all to doing real police work or serving the public. This is total insider baseball nonsense.
Yeah, it's like the Wild Wild West. It's kind of like they make up the rules as they go, but they're serving someone. They're just not serving people.
Well, they're serving themselves, but it's by design. I mean, it's intentional that it's messed up. It's intentional that it's confusing. There's a lot more literature coming out now about policing and bias, which all of this has got bias and racism written all over it, in my opinion. And how to inculcate a sense of responsibility and obligation and accountability in police officers. And so there isn't a consensus on how these officers or academies, et cetera, should be institutionalized so that they're producing people that don't hate the people they serve. They're trained to see the community as a threat. And each one of these instances shows that policing as an institution has real issues with the people they serve. And that's the huge part to fix. How do we have policing where it doesn't view the people that they're supposed to serve as a threat?
You know, how come that training isn't left in academy? The idea that you're trained to hate the people you serve, how come they don't leave that 10%? How come they don't leave that part in academy? How come that's the part, the only part that actually makes it out onto the street with them?
Because the academy only focuses a lot of only on using a weapon and all this, and not a lot on cognitive skills, decision-making, how to handle difficult situations. It could be because some of these officers don't have very much education in their pocket, right? And so they come to the table with not very many, I don't know, not a large cognitive skill set. And training is one thing, learning is another. I mean, nurses and teachers, those people are educated, and they're asking officers to be more educated now, but it has a long history of having officers who don't have very much education beyond high school.
It's spring, so that means I delve into the scary corners of my closet and try to purge what doesn't fit, what doesn't look good, and I hate to admit it, the few things that I have forgotten I even owned. We all have those. The salesperson said you looked fabulous. Well, that statement was inaccurate, and now you need to update your wardrobe. That's why I love La Tote, the fashion subscription box that sends brand name clothing and accessories right to my front door for one low monthly fee. Unlike the salespeople who have done me wrong in the past, the La Tote team are style and fit experts who use data to determine what works for me. I can rent up to $700 worth of fashion from designer brands like BCBG, Max Azria, Nike, Rebecca Minkoff, and more all month long. And for my million and one friends who are currently pregnant, La Tote has fashion forward looks for you to last 9 months. Sign up today and the store can bring you your very own bundle of joy, a maternity tote. Your size will change for 9 months. Now you don't have to buy maternity clothes that you'll never wear again. And you can avoid purging your closets and enjoying quality time with your baby. So go to latote.com, that's LETOTE.com, and get started for as low as $39 a month. Enter promo code undisclosed at checkout to get 50% off your first month. Once you sign up, you'll receive your completely customized tote within days. Wear what you want, return everything in the mail when you're done, and repeat all month long. Again, that's latote.com, enter your code undisclosed, and feel fabulous with fashion delivered right to your door.
So, Kelly, let's just talk about Keith Davis and his story and some of the work that, that you have been doing. Some of our listeners may not be familiar with Keith and what you guys had to go through.
Sure. So back in June 2015, Keith was shot at over 44 times by four Baltimore City police officers. We know now, today, that they initially lost their suspect that they were pursuing. Apparently someone had robbed a hack, and they kind of just got out, put guns out, and a crowd dispersed, and Keith was one of the people in the crowd that dispersed. They chased him into a garage, and they hit him three times. And from there, he was able to call me while it was happening. So I was able to hear them shooting and the call drop, and, you know, I find him next in the hospital. Since that, you know, when we get to the hospital, their police, they will not talk to us. They won't speak to us. They're just very sure that he's under arrest. Immediately, there's a press conference. The narrative went that he shot at officers and that he was robbing someone and he shot at officers. And still, initially, other than the press conference, which didn't make sense because I was talking to him, so, you know, none of it made sense. The police there, you know, we couldn't get any answers. I remember just calling down to the central station, and, you know, the police that were there on site, they weren't very receptive. They wouldn't answer my questions. Everybody just acted really bizarre, like something was off. And I called down to, I guess, headquarters, and they told me that he was going to be charged with attempted murder on a police officer. So they wouldn't let us see him. They wouldn't talk to us. And then Gaines and Anderson showed up, the FIT team, and told us that if anyone wanted to visit him, they had to first call them first. So initially, Keith got hit with 16 charges, everything from attempted robbery, first-degree assault on two officers, on a robbery victim. And, you know, he would go through plastic surgery. They rebuilt his face. He's just much titanium on one side of his face as he does bone. He would sit in jail for over 280 days and finally get to court, and for it to all come out that, you know, they had to be given some creative writing class down at the academy or the police station, because the charging documents and the evidence just didn't add up, even down to the robbery victim coming to court saying, hey, no, that's not Keith at all. So initially, they claimed that in this garage, they recovered a Hammerly pistol. They claimed that recovered from the pistol was a partial palm print, even though their narrative was that Keith ran down the street on a hot, sunny day with a gun in his hand, pointing it, dropping it, picking it back up, pointing it, dropping it, picking it back up. They said that it was like a partial palm print. And even though people testified that he was unconscious, that the print was consistent with not with what they were stating. We went through that trial. He was acquitted of all 15 charges. However, they added, and it's important to mention that no one spoke to Internal Affairs. No one spoke to the state's attorney's office for a whole, I'll say, 7 months. No shooting officers gave statements until about January. For six, June, July, August, September, October, November. The first statements were given in November. This happened in June. So you think about the 10-day rule.
That's astounding.
About the 10-day rule we're all fighting for in Annapolis, yet they did not, they weren't required to give a statement for a full 6 months, with some of them giving a statement as late as January of 2016. This happened June 2015.
So by that time, the FIT team wasn't even around. Just to interrupt you for a second, just for our listeners, I got in touch with Kelly because I realized the Keith Davis case has been in the news a lot lately, and I realized that it was the same Sergeant Gaines, Detective Anderson, the same team had been investigating like about a couple months after Freddie Gray. But now that team was disbanded as soon as Batts left office. So who was overseeing it?
They started it. So everything that we have has their names on it still.
Right.
And even if you go to his case search, their names are still there. We really don't know who took over because we really didn't get any cooperation. We didn't get any answers. Gaines and Anderson were the first month or two is when they were involved or so. That's the person that I would correspond with, me and Tashauna Gaines. So they were initially the ones who started the investigation. They claimed, like you said, that it was a criminal investigation and not an investigation into the police. They said that, you know, they were doing both, but one was supposed to come before the other, and we had an exchange about that because it just didn't make sense for the same ones to investigate the police-involved shooting to also investigate Keith as well. I guess that boils down to that criminal investigation and the administrative investigation. But once they were disbanded, we don't know who took over. We never really got any answers. The police were completely uncooperative from day one.
So they dropped the original 15 charges, but he's still sitting.
No, they didn't drop him. He went to trial and was acquitted.
Okay.
Yeah. He's still sitting because they came after his acquittals. They came back a week later and said, this gun we recovered in this garage was used in a homicide hours before you were shot by police. And wow. So they charged him with first degree murder. He just went through trial last week and it was a hung jury, 11 not guilty, within 10 minutes to one guilty.
And he's in jail still.
He's in prison. There's a difference.
Right. I'm sorry. That's right. And that's because they have decided to, they're considering pursuing the case again?
Yeah, the state's attorney is going to retry him again.
That's Marilyn Mosby, who goes after bad cops.
Yeah, but right. Porter had the same hung jury, 11-1, not guilty, and she dropped charges. But Keith, yeah, she's relentlessly coming after him.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, we think that it's a personal thing because I've spoken out against her, and I've called a spade a spade. I've taken more than just her sound bites and really did research and delve beyond the surface to see that there's a lot more at play here. And this was never about Freddie Gray. This was never about anybody being convicted. This was some self-serving attempt and a shoddy investigation in Freddie Gray's case. And in Keith's case, you know, it kind of supports that. So I've called her out on it, and somehow, some way, Keith is now.
You care to share some of the things that you found out about her and what she's doing, or?
Absolutely. Just down to the half investigations. You have one of the biggest cases of your life, and you don't take the time to adequately investigate. You don't take the time to look into stuff. As far as Keith's case, you claim to go after bad cops, yet you gave them letters of declarations without them ever giving you a statement. They were given letters of declarations and justified shooting Keith without ever speaking to them.
Who gave them the letter?
The state's attorney. They testified to that in court. Yeah, they were given a letter of declaration in November. They never spoke with them. And in fact, the new charge, which was unlawful possession with a felony conviction, the one charge that stuck from trial was a technical charge. Apparently, because he was unconscious on the ground with a gun on a refrigerator, had he wanted to possess it, because he has a CDS charge from 6 years ago, had he wanted to possess that gun, he could have. So he was in violation and he was guilty.
So just for our listeners, so like CDS is a drug charge. So he had a previous drug charge. Was he on probation?
He was done.
Okay. So he was done? Now, the gun was on a refrigerator, like on the top of a refrigerator, right?
On top of a refrigerator that they claim he used for cover. And apparently because that charge was added 6 months after the incident. It was almost as if once they gave those letters of declaration in January when they spoke to the police, they needed something to stick. And they knew that, you know, he was a prohibited person from that charge 6 years ago. So they knew that if anything stuck, that was it. Because the evidence they had proved that the rest of that stuff, you know, it wasn't true. The description that the officers gave, the description that the hack driver gave was all consistent. They were looking for a man with braids. Keith has always had low crop, wavy hair. They were looking for a man with no tattoos. He has tattoos. They were looking for a man and not in his clothing. And all of that came out in trial.
And I mean, and a different gun, right? Like, are they?
Yeah,
somebody saw it.
Yeah, they did. They described a silver gun, a black gun.
Do you think gun? You think that gun was planted?
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yes,
without a shadow of a doubt.
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me?
All right, so there's a really cool podcast I want you to check out. It's brought to you by the news organization that revealed Edward Snowden's secrets to the world. It's called Intercepted. Join veteran reporter and Intercept co-founder Jeremy Scahill for his weekly take on the current political moment and for provocative conversations about the issues behind the news. Scahill and guests like Julian Assange, Naomi Klein, Barbara Lee, and Dennis Kucinich discuss the most pressing issues of our time, those unfolding in public and the ones hidden in the shadows. Other guests are going to include Glenn Greenwald, Sam Biddle, Betsy Reed, and various writers from The Intercept. They've also got some really cool artists who come by and perform. They'll do audio dramas on the show. They'll include Peter Sarsgaard, Wallace Shawn, Bill Camp, and Anthony Adamanik, and Donald Trump. Yeah, that's right. I said Donald Trump. There's also artists who have performed original music on the show. You've got Brother Ali, Immortal Technique, Kimya Dawson, she's my personal favorite, Tom Morello, and Andy Flagg. The theme music is composed by DJ Spooky. So listen, Intercepted believes in holding those in power accountable, and the mission couldn't be more urgent right now. And neither could this podcast be. It's a really great listen. Check it out. Subscribe right now to Intercepted on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen to podcasts.
This is another thing I don't think our listeners understand, is that police officers in Baltimore City are notorious for planting drugs and guns and different types of evidence on people so that they can justify some of the horrible things that they do.
They shot the wrong person, and they knew initially, you know, some of the things that came out to court with the officers testifying, all of their stories were inconsistent because they were sequestered. Luckily for Keith's attorneys to be smart enough to do that, they couldn't sit together. All of their stories varied. It became very clear initially that they shot the wrong person. They even went to the hack driver and said, hey, we got the guy who tried to rob you. But they never took this guy to try to identify him. You know, they never took him to say, hey, is this him? And then, in fact, that came out in court that that's not even their policy. You're not supposed to leave a scene and go over here to say, hey, we got him. You know, he shot at us and we shot him back. Almost for everything, you know, they're trying to control their narrative. And then, at the same time, Keith was unconscious in this garage. These four shooting officers were responsible for surveying their own conduct. They had already had markers up before crime scene technicians got there. They testified they didn't get there until an hour later. Paramedic testified when he got there, they wouldn't even allow him to bring the truck up to the garage door. They just would allow him to wheel the gurney. They said he couldn't disrupt the crime scene. These officers survey their own conduct.
For those who don't know, a hack driver is kind of like a
illegal
Uber.
Cab driver.
It's like an Uber driver before Uber came out. It's kind of like a regular person. It's like a regular person with a car who will drive you anywhere throughout Baltimore City for between like $5 to $15. They normally stand out in front of like markets and stuff like that. Sorry.
And you don't rob them because they don't have money.
And you don't rob them. If you're gonna you don't rob them because they never have money.
They're hacking to
get a good day for a hack is like $75-$80, like tops.
Exactly.
And they spend that money throughout the day on like cigarettes and, you know, stuff like that.
Exactly.
So you know,
Everybody knows they're working. You don't rob them for money.
So it doesn't even make any sense. But for the people who don't know, sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, Keith was shot. You know, they shot the wrong guy. And you know that the bottom line is, even now in this new charge, we got trouble down the street. We shot the wrong guy. We can make this fit. And thus far is what they've been doing, trying to make it fit. And I truly believe that had the only reason why they came after him a second time after he was acquitted was because their narrative, to take a second bite out of the apple. They had to, you know, they've been doubling down. It didn't work. Here, you know, all of the things that everyone is now taking notice to, it's been refuted in court. And now we come back around with this new charge. And then I believe they anticipated we wouldn't be able to get him a lawyer. And we still got him a lawyer, and we fought it, and we got to court to know that there was CCTV footage. I mean, I know that's big with the Gray case. There was CCTV footage of this homicide. I mean, in one of the maps that the police showed, you can clearly see the camera, yet no one attempted to get this footage. No one.
So if I can tie in like some of what you're saying, I mean, it's overwhelming, this case. There are a lot of parallels with the Freddie Gray. And when we know that it's the same team doing the investigation, I think some of the parallels I want to draw, you know, what she said about the CCTV, we have a lot of CCTV footage or CCTV cameras at various stops, too many for all of them to have been inoperable. 1 minute of the camera that caught the arrest of Freddie Gray. So where is the rest? If you can provide 1 minute and you could play it at court, why isn't that available publicly as well? With the planting of evidence, well, first of all, the 7 cops who were indicted federally recently were notorious for planting guns. And there are questions with the knife in the Freddie Gray case about whether it is the knife that was picked up from him. And we got investigative binders. We're going to talk more about it, but there's a chain of clear evidence for all of the other items on Gray, and the knife doesn't have a clear chain of evidence. And it was turned in by that guy, Novak, who was one of the witnesses acting as an investigator. I also wanted to talk about the state's attorney, because I think that Marilyn Mosby's office has a particular flaw that is very common with prosecutors. You know, Undisclosed has recently, before the Freddie Gray case, was doing wrongful conviction cases. And we have wrongful conviction cases are very popular now in media. There are a lot of cases that people have learned about, like Making a Murderer on Netflix. And what you see in a lot of these cases, and you also see it with Freddie Gray and Keith Davis, is prosecutorial tunnel vision. They settle on a story and they cannot let it go, despite facts, despite public pressure. And I think that in addition to, you know, Kelly's conflicts with Marilyn Mosby, she seems to be very stubborn, and her office seems to be very stubborn about sticking with their stories. And that is very common among prosecutors. They decide on their story early for political reasons, and they stick with it, and they kind of refuse to let it go. And I think another thing that's interesting with Marilyn Mosby is after the Freddie Gray case, she became very, very worried about her relationship with the police department. And she worked really hard to establish a good relationship with Kevin Davis. And both of them have backed away from issues of police brutality. So I have a gut feeling that her standing by the officers in the Keith Davis case was a part of that, was like saying, I'm not going to do Freddie Gray again. That's just my gut feeling. I don't know what you guys think about that.
No, I agree. I agree. Keith is a sacrifice up to repair the relationship between her and the officers.
Why repair the relationship with officers when you should be trying to repair the damn officers? Like, these are the people that's out here fucking up, that's shooting people like wild cowboys, doing all of this crazy shit. Like, why are they considered so much?
Because they're confused.
They don't do shit. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Tracy.
They're confused. They're confused about what their role is in all of this. And they want to be liked.
Yeah.
People don't want to be unpopular. They don't want to do the right thing. They want to be liked. Who the fuck wants to be liked by a completely corrupt organization like the Baltimore PD? I think they should dismantle the whole damn thing. She's cozying up to them because they're pissed off at her. Maybe she's scared of them, too. I don't know. But it tells you a lot about the culture of that organization.
I don't think that she's scared of them. I think Marilyn Mosby is a very self-serving person. And I think that, you know, even down to Freddie Gray, at the time of Freddie Gray, I believe she exploited the climate of the city and everything that was going on. And she saw her opportunity and she seized it. I don't think she fully thought it out. And I think that the outcome of it was the strained relationship between the state's attorney's office. But if you look into the state's attorney's office, it's a strained administration, period. All experienced prosecutors, all strong, Black, experienced and vocal and prosecutors, they're gone. They left as soon as she got there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, if you really look into it,
Why do you think they left?
I think because, like she said, that prosecutor tunnel vision, but I think she has it. She has her, like she said, she's stubborn. She has her way. I mean, let's be real clear. We know that you see what you are a grown up in. Marilyn Mosby comes from a family of corrupt officers. She's bred in corruption. She knows how it moves. She knows how it works. If you're willing to go after people and get prosecutions and do whatever at any means necessary, and you have some people who still have their integrity and their morality intact, and we don't agree, it's either me or you. And some people, you know, in this city of Baltimore, which is so corrupt, and the collusion between the police and the state's attorney, you do still have some people who refuse to sell their soul at the end of the day for a hierarchy in their political career. And anytime there's been a strong Black woman and a strong Black man, I mean, not to dwindle it all the way down to race, they're willing to say no to her. She's willing to even make their situation so uncomfortable that they leave, or she terminates them in some way.
So let me ask you this, Kelly. How did you feel? What type of emotion shot through you when she first came out and announced those charges against those officers who participated in the killing of Freddie Gray?
Honestly, I was excited.
I can't front. I was excited. Like I was ready to pop bottles and all that.
Here's the thing. I grew up in Northern Pulaski. My mother moved me to the suburbs when I was 13. I have had no brush with the criminal justice system. You know, I didn't know anything. And to be honest with you, to be completely honest, I was somewhere that was far away from the uprising. I was far away from the Freddie Gray. If you ask me questions about it, I really didn't give an answer because I really didn't know. I knew something went wrong. I knew somebody was responsible. And, you know, the only encounters I had with Marilyn Mosby is at my church, which was Empowerment Temple at the time. And, you know, she would come and she would, and I felt like, okay, yeah, she gonna do this. She gonna stand up against everybody. She ain't trying to hear nothing. She's super bad sister. You can't tell her nothing. She know her stuff. So I was excited. And, you know, that's why even when this stuff happened with Keith, my first thing was like, oh, yeah, as soon as it gets to her desk, she gonna handle it. She gonna take care of it. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And to find out that, you know what, man? You've been bamboozled, too.
She and Tony Batts have a lot in common in that they're both showboaters, right? They're able to put on this show that I'm very smart. I have my act together.
Kevin Davis,
I can execute XYZ, and at the end of the day, the emperor has no clothes. They got no game, and they have no ethical or moral compass either. Hmm.
But I believe Davis is the same way. He's a showman.
Spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice. Peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. Elote style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano pep. Oh, wait, is this thing recording? Everybody can hear me right now? Oops. Hi, listeners. It's Amelia, and I was just looking over a few of Blue Apron's upcoming meals and salivating. They all sound so good. I'm a creature of habit and tend to get stuck in food ruts where I eat the same things all the time, including meals I cook at home. But I'm not a picky eater. I just don't take the time to seek out new recipes. One of the things I love about Blue Apron is how diverse and creative the menus are, and they don't repeat for at least a year. Every week, there are three new dishes for me to try, some of which I've already made again on my own. Blue Apron's sautéed fingerling potatoes and asparagus, are so delicious, they're my new go-to side dish. Although, that creamy lime and tomato rice sure sounds like it's gonna present some competition. Is anyone else hungry, or is my stomach just grumbling extra loud today? Anyway, Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everybody, delivering just the ingredients that are needed and in exact portions so there's no waste. And it's easy on your pocketbook too, with each meal costing under $10 per person. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Blue Apron has reminded me how much I love to cook. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Tracy, you were featured on our 9th episode. You have a background with Tony Batts, correct? You had some experience with him in Long Beach. And now you've continued to work on policing issues. What are you finding with police commissioners? Are they all similar? Are there good ones? What needs to happen in police leadership? Is there any hope, you know?
I'm really struggling. I'm really angry at our police chief right now because, as I said, their officer shot a black man last weekend or so, and the chief refuses to speak publicly to the community. He responded to an email to me, but I would say there is, again, a culture in policing where they think they're above the community. And the police are really us. And in some ways, we as a community are responsible for the police becoming what they are because We are a society that believes in punishment, and that if you do something punitive to somebody, it will change them. And it's been inculcated in this institutionalized, you know, bunch of gangs that get paid with taxpayer money, and it's outrageous. I'm really interested in his personality and why he's fearful of doing the right thing. And I think part of it has to do with police unions and the power that they have. I think that they're not well educated. I think they're not used to having to do a lot of critical thinking collaboratively. I think they do a lot of things in isolation and in collusion. So I think there's just a lot about policing that is undemocratic. And it doesn't bode well for being supplementally good to our society. It's very damaging. So yeah, that's what I've learned. Everything about what Kelly just said just infuriates me. But again, it's by design, and the police are able to take out whatever grievances they have using the system against the very people that they're supposed to be looking out for. And it's really sad. So I've been looking at, like I said, I've been looking at police curriculum and trying to figure out how we can get policing to change in our community. And I think a lot of people are in this place. How do we transform the culture of policing? How do we get them to not see us, the people, as a threat? How do we get policing itself to deal with race? Race is the constant in everything about policing, even when it's officers of color. And police are very resistant to having those conversations. They're very resistant to even looking at their own history. So getting them to transform is very difficult, particularly when the system hires people like Tony Bass, or people elect people. I don't know if Mosby's elected.
Yeah, she's elected.
People elect these kind of people, and the system protects them from being held accountable. All the way to the top.
I don't really believe in training. Like, I don't think training. I think
neither do I. I don't believe in training anymore either.
I think we're past that.
I think that we need to figure out a way to make police officers, to hold them accountable. I think we need to abolish the unions. The unions need to go. The unions need to go. All of these Bill of Rights laws and these different powers they have need to be destroyed. You know, so we already talked about civilian review boards. I'll just throw that out there again. Like, the people need more power. If you have the power to take out tax dollars to pay for these clowns, then we should have the power, you know, to be able to figure out what needs to happen when these people aren't doing what they're supposed to do. Because right now, they end up, they have nothing to lose. You can go out here, you can kill people, you can shoot people, you can harm people, and then you could be back at work within a few days.
I'm going to say one more thing about training versus education. You know, in healthcare, they have entirely changed the rubric for what is required to become a doctor, right? Because the outcomes show doctors, by and large, treated minority patients horribly, and they had horrible outcomes. So the entire curriculum and requirements for becoming a doctor have changed. You have to know about the social determinants of health. You have to understand poverty. You have to understand sociology. None of these things are required for cops, right? And they've had horrible outcomes forever. So I think the requirements for being a police officer need to change. I think a lot of cops come in, we're going to chase down bad guys. We don't want those people to be cops. So I think that they need to be educated. They say cops who are educated are much better officers. So the legal prescriptions, you know, whatever, but I think we're getting the wrong kind of people in policing. Just like we have the same problem in education with teachers, predominantly white institutions. People have no experience typically outside of their own race or whatever, and they get into schools, they can't deal with people who are different than them. The difference with cops is they have a gun.
You said something really interesting. You said police officers have terrible outcomes, right? That's the problem. They don't think they have terrible outcomes.
Yeah, because they never held
they never held accountable.
They're measured by the wrong thing. How many people you arrest, how many tickets you give out. So the rubric for measuring success is also a crooked room.
Right.
If I can play devil's advocate just for a minute, so in terms of unions, I think this is really, really interesting because, all right, when it comes to investigating cops' internal affairs, deciding whether or not cops should still have their jobs, it is true that they're given, a long 10-day waiting period. And there are some other rules that kind of protect them somewhat. That said, I'm pro-union. I think that working people should have unions. And when we look at what are the solutions in terms of recruiting better people to be police officers, one of them is actually paying them better. So it's kind of coming at it from a different point of view, like that these people that we find to be violating our rights so much, so challenging, almost functioning as a police state, that we may actually need to support them better and we would get better outcomes. Because if you don't, right now what's happening is that they're collecting so much in overtime wages, but they're not paid very well. And so it's not attracting the best people. And the other thing is that when you don't have, okay, training, that's an interesting puzzle. I agree. Training is a problem when it's policy-based. Follow this rule, that rule, that rule. Some of what Tracy's talking about, I talk to retired cops all the time. Some of them have become professors or reformers. Some of them are just retired and have thought things through. They believe that. I had one person tell me, we need to learn about the history of race in the neighborhoods that we're working in. One officer has created a new model of training. I thought, well, probably not new. It's being discussed in academia. I thought it was very inspired. For instance, when you stop, when a cop stops someone, right now they have sort of a three-step approach that starts with like, ask them to listen to you, and then ultimately compel them, order them. And he was saying, what if it starts with ask and it ends with convince, reason with them, reason with your suspects. And so I would keep training and I would increase salaries and I would support a union. I just think all of these things need to be reformed and probably the citizens need to be involved in their reform more than they would for, say, the plumbers union.
I don't know, Justine, because I don't think we can support police anymore. They get to kill people and keep their job. Like, how much more support? Right. Like, how much more support can you actually give them? And the way they collect overtime is wrong, but they still cashing the checks. They not complaining about collecting the overtime, and they not complaining about working them extra hours. So it's
some
like
of them
I don't really think we can. I don't think we can support them anymore. I think they get too much support because they're never held accountable.
From the Andy Jones era, when homicides was high, every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West, I be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, 14 already trying to ride, even when they go to school, they got the.
I heard a pretty intense story out of Racine, Wisconsin the other day, and I wanted to share it with you now. A house caught on fire. No one was home, and it took a while for neighbors to notice the problem. At the end of the day, there was $40,000 in damages. Priceless items gone. Family heirlooms charred. If you're not there when a fire starts, who will be there to save your home? For Simply Safe home security user Trisha, Simply Safe was there. While she was on vacation, her home caught fire, and she was three states away. But with Simply Safe, her smoke alarm went off. The fire department was alerted immediately, and they got there in time to save her home. Simply Safe's round-the-clock professional security monitoring is just $14.99 a month. Get 24/7 connection to dispatch and lightning-fast response times in emergencies with Simply Safe home security. Order today, and you'll get my special 10% discount. Go now to simplysafeundisclosed.com. That's simplysafeundisclosed.com for 10% off your home security system. simplysafeundisclosed.com.
You know, I think unions are important for working people, but when you have a union that just endorses death and justifies everything wrong that, you know, that the members do, it's kind of like the death penalty. Like, we can't have a death penalty in a country that just locks up black people for anything. And then, you know, so many innocent people have been murdered. Like, it just doesn't work. When it's just, when the whole system doesn't work, then none of it works. And then when, as far as the money's concerned, if you don't like to pay, don't be a cop. Like, nobody ever asked you to be a police officer. Go do something else for money. Like, you can't, like, you know, it's not like you sign up for the job and then they surprise you with this is the salary. You already know what the salary is before you actually take the job. So if you don't like the money, then just go do something else with your life. It's not like police officers can't work for, like, you know, FedEx. They can go do something else.
I don't think a lot of the cops out there, quote, deserve more money. The problem is we want to attract better people to be police officers. We want to make it seem like a good, noble profession that leads to a sustainable life where you could support your family. When the pay is raised, one of the problems with cops taking so much overtime is that it's more expensive than just raising the salaries. And overtime is used in ways that can be an incentive to lock people up. People lock up more people, they get overtime for court appearances. Raising the basic salary of police officers, raising the educational requirements of police officers, improving the culture of it so that the training seems noble and intelligent, like that it becomes a different kind of profession, is how you don't end up with thugs as cops. That's
but you,
sort of
you
where
know
we're
the
coming
pay.
From.
Like you locking up people just so you can make more money. That's a problem with you. That's not a problem with the system that created that job.
No,
that's
I your, think it's
that's
a problem
your
with
own,
the system.
That's your own. That's your. If I'm out here knocking people over the head so I can make more money on my job that I already knew to pay before I started, that's something internal with me. That's
supported by the system. In Long Beach, the officers got grants to increase their police force because, you know, the police department's always saying we need more officers. So what they did with that money is they let people collect overtime. I mean, I had to make a federal Freedom of Information request and hound them. Where is this money growing? You're not growing the department, because the other thing they can say is, oh, we can't do a better job because we don't have enough officers, right? So they have created an environment which is we get as much overtime as we want. The union, you know, will support us on this. And it's really insider baseball about how they collect money, not how best to run the organization for the community. So they're not deciding that for themselves. They've decided it as a department. It's a department policy. You would be shocked at how much they spent all that money they got from the feds they were supposed to use on growing the department on overtime, outrageous overtime.
I can't justify the actions of people that are incompetent or evil. Like, I just can't. Like, I'm not just going to sit here and say that, you know, because I took a job.
I'm saying it's institutionalized. That's all I'm saying.
A lot of these issues are definitely systemic. I totally believe that. But if I know that a job pays $40,000, $50,000, I'm not going to be like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and just ruin people's lives just for the sake of it because this job doesn't pay $60,000 or $70,000
a
year. Because I will also argue that some of those cops who do make nice salaries, they still do evil shit. Like, they still do the same. They still act the same way.
Just think about educators. They don't get paid very much either. It's about what we value in our society. One thing I will say about the police officers here in town that I have had an opportunity to get to know is they work a lot of hours. And one thing I don't like about it is they work so many hours is they don't have an opportunity to spend any time learning when they're not on the job. So learning is not valued on the job, and they don't have time to learn when they're off the job. And by that, I mean learning, just like if you're a teacher or a doctor or someone else, you're always learning so that you can be a better practitioner, right? They're very begrudging about any kind of training they have to do. It's a weird culture.
So cops who work with white kids, they get paid more, and that learning comes into place? Because if you see a black person, you can crack them over the head and act crazy. But when you see a white person, you like the captain of restraint, like the learning and the education and the humanity kicks in when you patrol in those types of neighborhoods?
All I'm saying is that the cops have created an environment where they have themselves maxed out, and they have an excuse for not learning how to do their jobs better because they have no time and they have no energy, right? That's what they say, is they have no time.
I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying, how come they learn how to do their job well when they're working with white people? How come when they're working with white people, they know how to do their job?
Well, I would say here that the white people also complain about the police, which is shocking, but there's no excuse for that.
They're not really getting killed, though.
Well, they have a bad reputation here as well. But what I will say is that the public also gets very intimidated anytime you try to deal with the police. I mean, our police chief denied that there's any racial profiling, even though we have all this data that he gives to the Attorney General's office. So again, when you start talking more closely with them, you realize there is a huge disconnect between them and the community. Huge, huge.
Can I pose a question just to the whole panel? If these police officers are so stressed out, so underpaid, and so overworked, right, and there's white neighborhoods, there's black neighborhoods, there's mixed neighborhoods in Baltimore City, how come all of the pain and the anger and the oppression goes towards the black neighborhoods? How come these overworked, frustrated, stressed out cops aren't going to Roland Park and knocking people over the head? How come it just doesn't?
That's because of racism, okay? Granted, but here's the thing. There are studies, I've read many of them, that show that undereducated police officers are more likely to be corrupt, are more likely to have unconstitutional arrests. We cannot build an educated, sensitive police force if it's not an attractive salary. That's just a fact. And not just an attractive salary, obviously, an attractive profession, you know? And part of being an attractive profession to somebody who's finished college and has aspirations for themselves is not just making bank 20 years down the line by working endless overtime and pulling a lot of arrests. That's not going to be appealing to people who leave college with aspirations for themselves. That's going to be appealing to people that we don't want to be officers. Raising the salary is a tiny part of what the kind of reform that would be required.
Agree,
Justin. But the officers are the officers that are already, and I get that. I get you want them to be trained better. I get you want to raise the salary. You
want. I want to say educated. People, I don't want to say trained anymore. I want to say educated.
Well, you want to educate them, and you want to raise the salary to make this profession be something that you get people who aspire more and that are more likely to be good officers. But at the same time, you can do that. And you can bring them in, but you can't get rid of the corruption that's deeply embedded. You can have officers that are higher paid, that are better educated, and then they are linked up with someone who's been there corrupting for so long. I guarantee you that the culture will be the same.
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me?
It's a sweet deal. I mean, it's a sweet deal to me. You can come out of high school. You can, you know, whatever, mess around for a couple of years, be a cadet. I don't know. 21, you can get a job. You can get benefits. You get a salary. You get vacation time. You get advancement opportunity. That's a pretty sweet deal. Like, in America, like where I'm from, where, you know, you can.
I was gonna say, where we come from.
Where
yeah.
I'm from, it's, I don't know, like, the social context that y'all are basing it on. But where I'm from, the people who go on to be firefighters and police officers, they made it. They love their positions, they brag right. about them, they get, you know, they buy houses, they get cars,
even
they love it, even yeah. a CO. So it's like, I don't, yeah. I, you know, and all of these people aren't super corrupt, but I'm saying for not needing some type of education above a high school diploma, this is a pretty sweet deal. You can actually yeah. experience social mobility. It's not the worst thing in the world.
I never said it was. It's just that if you have a college degree, it's going to be less appealing because there are going to be options that don't put you in the line of fire, that don't have a history of corruption, that don't seem demoralizing and overworking. So that it is very, very attractive to people with only a high school degree. And that's the problem. It needs to be attractive. It's the same problem with teaching in a way. We get some of the worst people in the classroom. I was a teacher. It was my favorite thing I ever did. And I could not support myself after a certain point.
But
you
the
know,
job is service, though. The being a cop is service. It's service. You're serving. You're not like, we're mm-hmm. not looking for sophisticated type of mm-hmm. cardigan, sweater, monocle, people walking around talking. We're looking for people who want to work in service.
Why can't that be sophisticated?
Service is sophisticated.
Yes.
Listen, the reason why we have a high discipline rate of Black children in this country, period, is because teaching is a predominantly white institution, right? They have the same problem as the police. They went through teacher education, which never dealt with any of these cultural things that are going on. Same thing with police officers, same thing with doctors, same thing with nurses, same thing with all these people, even lawyers, they're all having to go back to school. People have gone to school, have never been taught, you know what? You're gonna have to deal with people who are different than you. Big surprise for a lot of folks, all right? But the data says if a person has an education, they're less rigid, their cognitive skills are better, they have better communication skills. Some of the reports I'm reading, we're talking about cops who can't even write, barely yeah. write and read. I talked to a police officer that bragged to me that he hasn't read a book since 1976. So one small notch. I'm serious. I was like blown away.
No, I'm with you though. I know a lot of them are stupid.
The way that they're trying to do with teachers is, and I'm actually teaching a class like this at MU, is they're trying to introduce teachers during their educational journey to a lot of things that they've been brainwashed to believe, that meritocracy is a myth. A lot of the things that they believe about people who are different than them are totally bogus. And cops really resist, and so do my students, so do white students resist, But it hasn't been part of people's educational experience until recently. And the way that we get at this high discipline rate is they've got to get these white folks to deal with their racism. Whether they're closet bigots or they're, you know, explicit bigots, people are carrying a lot of baggage around in them because we live in a racist society. And we just need to get real. This conversation that we're having, we can barely have this conversation in our general audience in the world because people get scared.
This is how I talk when I walk up and down the street. And this is why, Tracy, this is why I don't have any friends. Because this is how I talk. This is how I talk when I walk up and down the street. So I definitely agree with you on that. This is such a great conversation. I hate to be the bad guy to bring it to a close, but I do want to get like a big final thought from everybody, starting with you, Kelly, and then to Tracy, and then to Justine.
You know, you can't like point the finger at one entity without all of them. In the city of Baltimore, all of this corruption, all of that stuff worked together. And like Dee said, where we come from, the black cops are worse than the white cops in our community. So, I mean, there's no easy fix unless you're willing to gut it all out and start from scratch. Because even if you bring in the new, you still got the old that's been running and reigning supreme. And at the end of the day, in Baltimore, the police have just been able to do whatever it is that they wanted to do for so long. And now you just have these other agencies and entities like the state's attorney's office that collude together. And I mean, ultimately, as citizens, we're best to just try to stay out the way because there's no help. There's no justice. It's the system. But there's too many things set in line to protect both the police and the state's attorney's office. They are the system. Therefore, they can't be a victim of it. So why does everything protect them?
Exactly. Go ahead, Tracy.
I want to say that Anthony Batts is a case study of what is wrong with policing in every way, in terms of recruitment, hiring process. He is the poster child for why policing is fucked up. And not only that, he's a black PhD. So this is a different way of looking at race through him. I also think a lot of these cops need to have a psychological profile before they go into policing. Two quick things. Kelly mentioned about you can have good guys and then the police department can go to hell in a handbasket because they've got corrupt people in there. In Oakland, they've been under a consent decree for 15 years. They brought in a great chief. They just did a documentary about Oakland. It's called The Force, produced by Peter Nix, and it went down because of an inside prostitution ring, which I believe Tony Batts had something to do with. Number two, so here you had a guy that comes in, he's a great chief, and they're trying to make all this change, and they could not get at that internal toxic culture. It prevailed despite all the good work that they were doing and went through, like, I don't know, three or four chiefs in a few months trying to get somebody clean in there. The last thing I wanted to say is there's really great research, really great work being done in policing. I'm reading right now Suspect Race, Causes and Consequences of Racial Profiling by Jack Glazer. It's really getting at the point that you cannot train people out of their biases, that what they have to do is reduce police discretion. So they need to take power away from the police to make decisions, to control them, because they're not able to control their bias. Everybody has them. You can't train people out of their biases. You can raise their awareness, but you can't train it away from them. Same thing with cultural diversity and stuff like that. I think the way that we're presenting diversity, et cetera, to officers is not meaningful to them, where they have to investigate and question themselves. And I think that's an important part of being any kind of professional that serves the community. You have to have nuance and sophisticated skills so you can walk in more worlds besides your own.
Thank you. And Justine.
Okay, so when I talk about raising salaries and actually maintaining a union, it may sound like a contradiction, but I like the idea also of gutting the Baltimore Police Department and starting over. So, I mean, at the bottom, it's accountability for sure and much better leadership. A story that stuck with me is something that happened in New York NYPD. It kind of turned around a lot over the last few years in terms of reduced incidents of force, is that a commissioner came on and told all of his deputies, write your letters of resignation and put them on my desk, meaning I'll let you know if I'm going to keep you. You may not be up to the standards of what I have planned, which was a culture of much greater accountability and really enforcing among cops that they should be scared that if they witness any wrongdoing, they're implicated unless they report it. So that is more important and most important. But we need to attract better people to policing by far. Sensitive people, compassionate people with some experience in the world beyond just their suburban household and mall.
A commitment to service.
Yeah.
Thank you. You guys were great. It was amazing conversation. I'm so thankful that I had the opportunity to be a part of it. Kelly, where can people find you at on social media? Or do you have any cause that people should be donating to?
There is the Keith Davis Legal Defense Fund as we go. And because, of course, the state's attorney's office have not dropped the charges. They're going to retry him. You can find that at fundraiser.com and just type in Keith Davis Jr. You can find me on Twitter at 50 Shades of Kels, K-E-L-L-Z, as well as Free Keith Davis. You can find all information there. Or you can just hashtag Keith Davis Jr. on Twitter and all of the information will pop up. But thanks so much for allowing me the opportunity.
No. Thank you. And Tracy, how can we find you? How can we find you and support you?
I'm on Twitter at Tracy Liz and at Race Matters Friends Como. You can also find us on Facebook at Race Matters Friends Como. That's our Facebook site. We are trying desperately to reform and transform our police department here in Columbia, Missouri. So I'll be supporting you on this, and Kelly, and get people to write letters and speak up
if
that helps you. And it's all about raising the consciousness, in my opinion, of white people to speak truth to power, but also to get black people engaged. So we're working together collaboratively. It's not one person's responsibility. We all have to do it.
Thank you. And Justine, where can we find you?
Justine3000 on Twitter.
Thank you so much. Thank you, guys. You know, and I'm thankful for today because I'm going to start my new foundation. It's going to be called Cops Should Have to Volunteer 10 Years Before They Actually Get a Salary.com. What do you guys think of that?
Well, you know, to be a doctor, you have to do service.
You have to do service
and you have to show that you understand the social determinants of health, that you understand that poverty is not something people volunteer for. Right?
Yeah, then we'll know the difference. Understand. We'll know the difference between, you know, the people who call themselves heroes and the people who are looking for, like, you know, to beat people over the head for overtime.
Yeah, I want to be in that organization. Let me know about it.
All right. Yeah. All right. Okay. Thank you guys again. And remember, fans, to participate in a social media discussion using the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray. Tag questions for future addenda with hashtag UDAddendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at UndisclosedPOD. Thank you for tuning in and have a blessed day.
Before we hit the credits, I've got an ask for our fans. So as you know, we are relying on advertising as a way to keep this show free. We want to keep it free. If you could do us a favor and go to the following URL, listen up. It's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed, spelled just like I said it. podcastlistener.com/undisclosed. If you could answer a few short questions there, it would be really helpful to us. Again, that's podcastlistener.com/undisclosed. And rolling into the credits. The Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Thanks to Ryan and Ernesto for continuing to support us. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum along with super producer Methil Telhan. A big thanks to Le Tote, Intercepted, Blue Apron, and Simply Safe for sponsoring this podcast. To our fans, thank you for supporting our sponsors. Great sponsorship makes for great podcasts. Patrick Cortez composed the Undisclosed Addendum's theme music. The embed track is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who lends his sound to our show. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Undisclosed Pod. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 13. Until then.